I'm Rick Derderian, and this is Realms of Memory.
Franklin Roosevelt was the first president I ever voted for, the first to serve in my lifetime that I regarded as a hero, and the first I ever actually saw. That was in 1936, a campaign parade in Des Moines where I was working as a radio announcer. What a wave of affection and pride swept through that crowd as he passed by in an open car, a familiar smile on his lips, jaunty and confident, drawing from us a reservoir of confidence and enthusiasm some of us had forgotten we had in those days, in those hard years. He really did convince us that the only thing we had to fear was fear itself.
In the final days of his presidency, Ronald Reagan recalled that it was Franklin Roosevelt who inspired him to go into public service. Like millions of others who experienced the hard times of the Great Depression, it was FDR's optimism and confidence in the future that won over the young Ronald Reagan. Yet by the end of Reagan's presidency, there was still no national memorial to FDR in Washington, D.C. How is it possible that it took over 50 years after FDR's death to build a national memorial to the most popular president of the 20th century? How do Americans remember the Great Depression and FDR's New Deal response? In his book project Hard Times USA, The Great Depression and New Deal in American Memory, University of Mississippi historian Darren E. Grimm explains how we remember this past and how it shapes our experience of hard times in the present. Darren Grimm, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to talk with you all today.
Your project looks at the memory of the Great Depression, the New Deal. Can you help us understand the magnitude of it, the extent to which it affected the country? What was novel about the New Deal response to it?
What Americans really confronted in the 1930s was what seemed like the wholesale collapse of capitalism itself. Stocks lost nearly 90% of their pre-crash value by 1933. Something like a third of the nation's banks had failed, and that meant deposits had flown out the window. The money's no good. You don't really have insurance for that. GDP shrunk by a third in those 4 years between about 1928, 29, and 1933. I mean, people are losing homes, they're losing savings, they're losing a sense of security. Some of them are losing their minds. I mean, this is mass deprivation that creates a context for really mass desperation. So historians have written at length about the causes of that. They've debated at length the causes of it and the implications of it. And they've also written about and debated at length the political response, which became known as the New Deal, which is what Franklin D. Roosevelt, running in 1932 as a Democrat against the Republican incumbent, Herbert Hoover. That's what he runs on. And it offered really not necessarily for the first time, but in the most forthgoing manner, a vigorous federal response that historians have argued out, but have concluded birthed kind of modern American state. And this New Deal, as a nickname, you might say, for this federal response, it very much privileged consumer well-being. It privileged a measure of protections and provisions for workers, everything from union affirmation to thousands of public works projects to, of course, most famously, Social Security, that brought real reform, real relief, real recovery for millions of Americans, or at least it felt like it did, however unevenly. So that's why this era matters. That's why it's received so much historical attention from historians. But that's also, for me, why it presented such a strange omission when it came to the remembrance of all that. You know, we have plenty of books on American memory and various crises throughout American history, but it seemed like the 1930s, the early 1940s, this era of the Great Depression, the New Deal, had been remembered by Americans, but had not been documented by historians or really studied by historians in terms of the moral implications of these years and these crises and these political transformations. So that's what my next book that I'm working on, Hard Times USA, the Great Depression and New Deal in American Memory, is going to be all about.
So one of the ironies is I'm listening to you because frankly, FDR is often credited as being a great communicator, and he mastered this new technology of the radio and his fireside chats, and that his effectiveness of maybe communicating his program was his ability to use the technology to communicate the message of what was happening. Yet after he dies, there's this inability to communicate that past. No one else seems to be able to take that message, that history, and package it in a lasting kind of way that's going to have a lasting impact on the national culture. So you stress as this theme throughout that you end up with a fragmented memory of this past. So there's some initial efforts at it, and you see some of them fizzle out right away. There's this group of people, prominent New Dealers, they get together in New York to try to put together a memorial. That doesn't last, right? And the one that does have more, make more of a splash is at Warm Springs, Georgia. So that does gain some traction. And you discuss some of the ways, commemorative or memorial aspects of that, how that gets wrapped up in religion. And that if you're trying to understand how that worked, there was a particular religious theme at work, and almost like a conversion experience for people. If you went there, that was the idea. So I was hoping you could talk about, well, the place that did work, Warm Springs, you know, how did they try to craft that memory there? How was religion tied up? And why does this project end up itself kind of seem over time? It seems like it loses steam, lasts longer, but it seems like it falls into the same category of a lot of the other sites of memory that are connected to that past that for some reason they don't resonate over the long run.
Right. And for your listeners, just to remind them, Warm Springs, Georgia is where Franklin D. Roosevelt died in April of 1945. And he had gone to Warm Springs initially to find some relief from his own physical infirmities brought on, of course, by polio. He'd gone to Warm Springs for the better part of 20 years before he died. And it's a place that almost immediately that what his fans locally, as well as other New Dealers, want to do is they want to enshrine the New Deal there at Warm Springs. And they very much use that type of religious language in order to do so. In fact, they concoct a plan almost immediately to collect oral histories and narratives about FDR as this friend, certainly of the common man, but of someone that understood the nation's pains because he felt that in his body, you know, a kind of sacrificial, almost scapegoat motif that's drawn certainly from certain facets of Christian practice and social and cultural attitudes. That in a context of a heavily evangelical place like South Georgia is going to resound and resonate. But they also pull in, you know, pursuits of trying to enshrine him there that seem akin to almost like what's been done. And there's been a lot of historical study of the Lost Cause and how much of it is shot through with religious iconography and language and theological outlooks that then get applied very much to FDR as a person, but more pointedly to the New Deal as a kind of secular manifestation of the state that these religious kind of motifs help shape. And that gets put in very concrete terms, pun intended, at Warm Springs. They don't touch the bed where he died. They leave it as is. They don't touch the physical environment at large part. I mean, they upkeep the landscaping and whatnot, but they don't change the physical layout of the place, even down to the sort of dry goods in the cabinetry there, to the way the his desk is situated, and just so to the they have signs that say this is the president's chair where he was sitting or would sit. This is the chair which he died in when Elizabeth Shumatov, who was actually the artist doing his final portrait there, which was an unfinished portrait because he had a brain hemorrhage, and I think in the same day, so that he was sitting for that portrait. and then died. So they left the portrait unfinished, almost as as captured in time, even down to the toilet paper roll in the bathroom, which still today you can go to, is in plexiglass, sort of captured in amber, captured at this flashpoint, this moment in 1945 when he died. And all of this is intended, as many shrines are, to make seem eternal that which is, of course, temporal, to make seem eternal the New Deal, and FDR is the embodiment of it, an embodiment of that type of vision of political life or proper relationship between, say, capitalism and the state. It's all intended to kind of sacralize that, make it sanctified, and secure it ostensibly for tourists to come to. And to your question as to why that resonates into the 1940s and 1950s, it's a very intentional effort by the Warm Springs Memorial Commission to set this up. It becomes something of a tourist attraction. It's clearly a nation that's in mourning, missing FDR. I mean, this is a profound, for many in the American public, a profoundly shocking moment, akin to later on the JFK assassination. You know, something you remember where you were, what you were doing in the moment that you heard that FDR, this absolutely iconic figure, becomes an icon in memory. And that's the place where all of that type of emotional energy at least initially focuses. And they have hundreds of thousands of visitors come there in the late 40s and the 1950s. And, you know, until admittedly, you know, certainly the course of history starts to take on different people's attention and emotional energy. Certainly the Cold War and other political representatives take up the mantle of FDR and run with it in the 1950s. And these sites fade sort of naturally from memory. But there are other sites that I've researched and will argue in the book that it's not just this kind of natural course of history, a natural course of misremembrance or forgetting, that these sites actually still resound well into the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s for clear reasons, and will have sort of political import in the ways in which they resound. But yeah, those places like Warm Springs absolutely take up a lot. They sort of absorb a lot of the cultural meaning of memory, at least initially in the 1940s and 1950s.
My impression, though, is that Warm Springs, almost like a lot of these other New Deal projects, it becomes part of this ruined landscape. Now, you fast forward in time, it becomes a depressed community. So ironically, it's like the free reign of capitalism that the New Deal was supposed to shelter people against ends up undercutting this community. And you mentioned there's no place even close by where you can even stay. And a lot of the businesses that try to capitalize on that past don't really succeed. So it's almost like, you know, you have this, you know, rusted landscape of memory. I mean, I'm broadcasting from Massachusetts, and whenever we drive to the Cape, we go over these bridges, the Sagamore and the Bourne Bridge, and you see the 1930s labeled on them. There are those Depression era relics.
Right.
But I think for most people, especially in light of recent news stories, you're thinking more about, boy, I hope they've maintained those. I hope that's not going to collapse underneath.
Right.
You're not thinking what a great, you know, remembrance of the past this is.
Right. And I think it's important to back up to when those bridges, those dams, those schools, those airports were bright, shiny, and new. And I think they had that element of being truly, for millions of Americans, the introduction of themselves to modernity. And you're right to note, and that's a bit later on in the book, in the 1960s and 1970s, when you get to the simple fact of the matter, is that many of those infrastructural projects, whether they're a discrete memorial site to the New Deal and to FDR, like his little White House at Warm Springs, it is updated, it is maintained, but it just simply becomes less and less popular. But their surrounding area undergoes all the significant economic duress of the 1950s and 60s in the South, and farm mechanization and movement of people away from these types of small towns to bigger cities because they just don't have jobs, and they go into kind of a free-falling collapse. Well, that's also in terms of some of the updating of these work sites. And unless there were prominent work sites, they were deemed essential to the infrastructure and maintaining the infrastructure of the United States into the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Yeah, they go into disrepair. and they become very much these kind of landscapes of forgetting or landscapes of a different type of remembrance of what the state can, could, and should do for you, which is I think a vision of these public sites as places of disrepair and as symbols of the government falling apart, you know, of especially in these kind of much more anti-government political context of the 1960s, 70s, and 1980s. They become, in certain points, sort of symbols of government failure rather than what they were initially designed as, which is symbols of sort of government intervention that was often deemed to be a benefit.
But you mentioned, too, that, I mean, even immediately after FDR dies, I mean, there are some projects you think, well, how could that possibly not have worked? I mean, wouldn't there have just been some natural momentum and support? So the Warm Springs Project, it's able to stay the course, but there's another one in New York that just falls apart early on.
Yeah, there was a memorial commission, a Franklin Delano Roosevelt Memorial Foundation. That is founded by New Dealers. It has some real heavy hitters in the midst of it. Francis Perkins, for instance, Eleanor Roosevelt is involved in it, and a series of other prominent New Dealers that take it upon themselves, their mission to simply ritualize both the date in which Franklin Roosevelt died, to ritualize that, but also to push out what they saw as a living memorial. And they were very adamant that they didn't want to necessarily establish what they thought would be, by contrast, you know, fixed memorials or brick and mortar memorials, you know, marble memorials to Franklin D. Roosevelt. That I, looking back on it and analyzing it, I think, why didn't you do that? Because the only memorial that was really, really pushed and prominent and popular by 1946, 47, 48 was the reframing of course, the dime to having FDR's head on it. It was much more pushed from the perspective of the March of Dimes and anti-paralysis or anti-polio endeavors that ended up being, you know, something that's in literally everyone's pocket in the 1950s and 1960s. Part of this was FDR was adamant himself. He didn't want a memorial. He wanted a very modest one, if at all. He actually designed his own gravestone or marker at Hyde Park. And he was adamant and to other New Dealers that I did not want that to be, you know, the way in which I would be memorialized. Rather, I wanted it to be much more in sort of programs or additional philanthropic endeavors or what they saw as intellectual considerations of the importance of the New Deal that they thought would result in being more living memorials that would outlast them. You know, the idea that ideas outlast whatever is laid down in marble. Well, it ends up that in the 40s, late 40s and early 50s, this works for a time, but there's a bit of people cycling off on going into other projects, getting other political appointments, retiring as New Dealers, or just simply dying. And this results in the organization itself foundering when it comes to fundraising for these types of living memorials that end up, I think, you know, from the perspective of FDR's memorialist, really undercutting their mission by the 1950s and 1960s. And so what's left is the physical infrastructure of the New Deal itself that very much has a strong unevenness in terms of how Americans remember them and remember that infrastructure as contributive to assuaging their economic traumas from the 1930s or maintaining their own social and cultural and political importance into the 1950s. Because as I note, there are certainly infrastructure projects that are quite controversial, that are not deemed to be altogether beneficial to certain communities. The one that certainly comes to the forefront is the TVA, or the Tennessee Valley Authority, a very revolutionary infrastructural project that had precursors before the New Deal that is involved in everything from dam building to rural electrification to flood control. But, you know, through, you know, the sort of troubling use of eminent domain, floods entire towns and communities, often with very little financial recompense, that really sows some seeds of disdain towards the New Deal that the TVA is seen at once as, you know, a great harbinger of progress and modernity on the one hand, rural electrification, the pulling of certain communities into modern life on the other hand, as being devastating for both their environments and, if not, their own, you know, sort of property holdings that certainly cultivate a kind of strong antagonism towards the state. And the TVA is this sort of memorial landscape from the 1930s, well into the 1940s and 1950s.
So even tapping into that landscape of public works projects, that's not a clear-cut thing. People have mixed feelings about that past. But as you were speaking, if FDR didn't want a memorial to himself, I couldn't help thinking about my episode with Erica Doss, Memorial Mania, and she has a chapter where she talks about this remembering of the Greatest Generation and this misconception that they were forgotten, that they hadn't been acknowledged. And she argues that actually there was a lot of living memorials that were built after World War II. And that was the idea, is that coming out of this conflict with Nazi Germany and also the history of the Soviet Union, that building these monuments to great leaders was kind of politically incorrect. They moved off in a different, you know, different direction.
Yeah. And if I said, you know, I have some research on this and some availability, as if there was a mania for memorializing FDR, it was actually abroad, you know, in places like everywhere from Brazil to Western Europe, in which modest monuments, place names, naming a school here, a road there. But nevertheless, abroad, where FDR, either in terms of the global influence in the New Deal and various public works programs, especially in Latin America, or in terms of obviously his status as a commander in chief and, you know, clear importance as a military figure that, you know, beats back the Nazis in Western Europe, there's that push that's there. But in the U.S., especially in his inner circle, they seem to take this approach more of seeing it as in more as the memory would sound more in these kind of high-minded modes of a living memorial instead of something that was more physical in nature. It's not until I think 1974 that you have the first push for a national FDR monument. It's relatively late in the game, and by that time, this is, you know, perhaps far beyond the kind of initial emotional and social and political energy to have him memorialized. You know, all that said, Americans love memorializing, and we love tchotchkes. We love, you know, being able to take our history and summarize it into a small piece of bric-a-brac. And there is, I do have documentation of what it's called, Rooseveltania, which is this kind of like push for small little modes of remembering FDR, you know, ordinary Americans holding on to letters that they received from his office. Memorialists that are getting together in these small communities of trading little bits and pieces of Roosevelt memory, you know, pins, buttons from his campaigns, campaign posters, et cetera, in the 1940s and 1950s. Again, relatively small in number, very much, you know, more of what you'd find in, you know, similar to like kind of, comic book fanfare, collectibles and so forth. Yeah, collectibles that continue. And then, of course, most notably, like kind of the serious trade, like Depression era glassware that continues in the 50s and 60s that is, again, not in these well-noted or put into the, you could put a pin in the map places of memory that are devoted to Roosevelt, but still nevertheless show the kind of remnants of Roosevelt memory well after he's dead and gone.
So if we push into the 50s and the 60s, it seems like there's a tug of war over this past that you have. You mentioned there's a civil rights movement, there's a women's movement, and they can see certain advantages in trying to tie themselves to that past. And at the same time, conservatives, they're faced with this dilemma that they're tied to Hoover. He's often seen as the greatest failed president up to that time. They need to figure out, they're saddled with the blame for what was done wrong in managing the Great Depression at the start. So they have a strong incentive to try to recast that past in a way that's going to work to their advantage. So how does that work? And it seems like that tug of war, in the end, it's conservatives that come out on top. By the time you get to the 1970s, they basically win out. If there's a memory war, they're the ones who carry the day.
To your point and to what you raised in terms of where conservatives fit into all of this, I mean, there had been virulent opposition to the New Deal through the 1930s and 1940s. There had been vigorous consternation on the part of Herbert Hoover regarding the New Deal. He fought it tooth and nail even before he got into office. He once he was out of office, he was a notable critic of it. And he, even though he put his energy into a lot of different endeavors into the 1940s and 1950s, he never got over, and his supporters never got over what they thought and what they put bluntly as a smear campaign against him, not just during the election, but in the aftermath and in the memory. I mean, it's worth remembering that Herbert Hoover doesn't die until 1964. He actually dies, interestingly enough, right there in the midst of this knockdown, drag-out fight between Lyndon B. Johnson, the heir apparent to the New Deal, or how he often characterized himself, and Barry Goldwater, who saw himself as something of a Hooverite and acolyte. And, you know, throughout the 1950s and 1960s, you see intermittently, it's not terribly well organized, but an intermittent endeavor to try to redeem Herbert Hoover. But where conservatives notice and they acknowledge and understand how many Americans, rightly or wrongly, blamed Hoover for starting the Great Depression. They characterize this as a smear campaign. They characterize Hoover as someone unjustly adjudicated in the court of public opinion as someone who was indifferent or didn't care about the American public. And historians have shown that's not the case at all, that there were, sort of precursors of the New Deal that Hoover instituted and explored. But they worked vigorously during the 1950s to try to restore Herbert Hoover's character, restore his impression of being a statesman, of being someone that wasn't indifferent, but nevertheless was trying to pursue certain political solutions to the Great Depression that didn't work out, but nevertheless either laid the groundwork for the New Deal or were better than the New Deal. And by the 1950s and 1960s, you also have economists. I mean, the most famous one in the 1960s and into the 1970s would be Milton Friedman, who sort of presents a contrarian point of view on what exactly caused the New Deal that cuts counter to John Maynard Keynes and cuts counter to sort of economic received liberal economic doctrine, and presents a perspective that the folks that made the New Deal made the Great Depression great were the New Dealers. And this becomes one of the things that he deploys and uses. It's not just economic models, but a kind of vision of remembrance and reinterpretation of economic history from 1926 to about 1934. To prop up this new vision of conservative economics that is certainly not all about just the New Deal and historical remembrance. That would be a gross simplification, but it is centered around this kind of redemptive process of clarifying their critiques of the New Deal as wrongheaded at best and injurious to the American public at worst, that kind of tracks with the way in which Herbert Hoover had viewed the New Deal ever since. I can go into, there are historians, there are folks working out of the Hoover Institution and Stanford University that are engaged in this type of historical PR campaign for Hoover. And all I'll say is that it's at least effective enough by 1964 that when he does die, there are much more favorable perspectives on Herbert Hoover as statesman, as someone that had been sort of erroneously interpreted as indifferent or even nefarious when it came to his political approaches to addressing hard times. And you have, a lot of different folks from the left and the right and the middle reinterpreting Herbert Hoover in many ways the way he wanted to always be remembered, which was as a statesman and as a capable politician, a real social engineer with political acumen, that by the time he dies in 1964, he's much more favorably reviewed, in his death. And it's not just that typical kind of, that typical just just pablum about a dead politician that you receive. It's genuine kind of appreciation and reaffirmation of Hoover as a misunderstood figure in American life that he had vigorously worked on, knowing that redeeming the memory of the New Deal, the memory of the Great Depression was of a part of redeeming his own memory, and by extension, the memory of conservatism itself as a viable political philosophy or political approach instead of what it was often interpreted as by not just liberals, but millions of Americans moving into the 30s and 1940s as something that brought us into the Great Depression to begin with. But he's only one of any number of Americans that are wrestling with this legacy of the New Deal, what it all means in terms of its limits, or in terms of it as a type of political approach that can, could, or should be criticized.
So by the time you get to the 1970s, the country plunges into the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like at that point in time, the idea of any kind of reformist, large state-driven response is just out of the question. That past as an alternative has been thoroughly discredited.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not like it didn't happen before. I mean, every single time there was an economic downturn or a recession, whether it was just a few months or lasted for 6 to 8 months or even a year in the post-war era, Americans held their breath. And you'll see this uptick in newspaper articles about, is this another Great Depression? I mean, that to me is, I think, you could theorize as just it's a traumatic response to new forms of anxiety inducing stimuli, such as, downturn in sales or a slowdown. But, there was a post-war readjustment recession in 1948, 1949. You see this uptick in concerns and worries about whether or not Truman is going to be another FDR and be able to handle this economic downturn. Is this going to be another Great Depression? Are we, what happens when all this federal spending, especially in the military, gets pulled back? There's another one that people forget about right there in 1954, there's slowdowns in 57 and 58. And there's another one in 1960 and 1961 before we get to, what I call euphemistically the boomers boom, which is, 1961 to 69, when there's really 8 years of just uninterrupted non-recessionary growth, that each one of those bring back, albeit much, much more among the academic types or folks who would write for the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times, these kind of concerns. But Americans at large, especially if they experience the Great Depression, cannot hold their breath a minute whenever there are downturns or recessions. And then when the big ones hit, in the midst of course, the inflationary spikes and the oil shocks and the economic readjustments from military spending in Vietnam and on and on and on. I mean, the real travails of the 1970s show up. This is a period of time in which the Great Depression, in memory, for lack of a better term, is hot again. And it shows back up. I mean, you have television shows that are, of course, attentive to it. You have writers that are writing yet again about hard times. You have activists that are trying to bring attention to the racialized elements of hard times in the 1960s and 1970s that informed, liberal economic policy and LBJ's day and the Great Society and so forth, but, are reaffirmed and show back up. And, one television show that I use and focus on that present a very complicated take on how to make sense of economic recession in the 1970s via the Great Depression is, of course, The Waltons, which is a popular television show taking direct inspiration from the 1930s. It's about a fictional town in Western Virginia that's going through the Great Depression, and it's instructive or interesting when and where the New Deal shows back up. It's often a background character. Showing up just as a prop here and a prop there, but there are episodes such as a later episode much later on in the series, interestingly enough, right as Reagan is starting to make waves, that's all about FDR's death and a memorialization of that. And it's interesting how for as much as the New Deal state is in the background or just intermittent in that show, what is very much prevalent are presentations of kind of working class heroes in the form of the Waltons themselves, the threats to their own standing that's more akin to a way in which many suburbanites are feeling in the 1970s of these external threats coming to their communities is in certain forms of fashions, obviously economic concerns about just simply how you make it to the end of the week. But the Waltons both on the one hand reaffirm what you might see as kind of conservative solutions to these economic problems, you know, a tight-knit family, a two-parent family, an extended family, supposedly passing on traditional values to their children. But at the same time, that show made room for discussing everything from racism to domestic abuse to drug problems as well, that seemed to be more attentive to the real concerns and troubles of Americans making their way through the 1970s. But it's that's just one instance of that's in keeping with this real attention to certainly working class heroes and working class concerns coming to the forefront in the 1970s, but using the Depression as the means by which we try to make sense of it all.
So you see that show and you think at first, and I happen to have watched a lot of episodes of that in the past. I've had that theme song stuck in my head ever since I've heard your presentation and read it. So you see it and you think, oh, okay, here's a revival of that past, but there's going to be a throwback and a recollection, but it's less in sync with the 1930s, you stressed, than the 1950s, that it doesn't really harken back much to the 1930s, that if you look at the Waltons' home, that this is a much more comfortable setting than you're going to find during that area. A lot of the poverty is just stripped out of the show. A lot of the deprivation that era represented in that part of the country, you don't see it anywhere. So, I mean, the show is kind of erasing that past and grounding you in the security of another era. And it's all about family values. I mean, the New Deal programs, they're just nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, it's a fascinating show. I mean, it's a complicated show. I think it definitely is on the one hand, a conservative show. On the other hand, I think it's informed and it's in living in the aftermath of 1960s demands for representation, particularly of racial minorities, particularly of women. I think it's attentive to that. And it has all of these curious sort of nuances and throwbacks that I found particularly just delicious as a historian to acknowledge. Like Zebulon Walton, grandpa, right? The actor for that is Will Geer, who was a friend of Woody Guthrie. They were roommates actually at one point. He himself in his personal life, homosexual or bisexual, one of the sort of fuzzy, unclear, but also leftist. I mean, definitely a leftist from the 1930s and 1940s. Actually was blacklisted during, of course, the Red Scare of the 1950s, was something of a clandestine writer for various television shows, and then just gets brought in, brought into, Earl Hamner's world, the writer of the Waltons, who wrote all the kind of fictionalized novels to set all of this up, brought in literally just because he said he looks like Zebulon Walton, my imagining of grandpa. So he is this, now becomes kind of the figure of sort of family values centric, not quite patriarchy. I think that's too much of a work, because the women in that show very much have a complicated kind of relationship to labor and work and the certain values, but nevertheless held up as this almost kind of grandfatherly figure that's almost like the FDR of the family. I mean, admittedly, he's much more, cornpone and hokey and so forth, but still is a complicated figure that gives off these sort of warm, familial vibes that the show is intending to do in general as a kind of redemptive narrative regarding good old-fashioned American values that are derived from the hard times of the Great Depression, but updated for the hard times of the 1970s. The point of all of that is that by certainly the 70s and 1980s, the Great Depression has gone from this kind of collective memory in some ways that is still fraught internally fragmented to decidedly fragmented and much more picked up in these points of remembrance, whether you're talking about the Waltons as a television show, in the 1970s, or you're talking about it in terms of Bruce Springsteen carping off of Bob Dylan, who's carping off of Woody Guthrie and some of his, you know, sort of Reagan era records like Nebraska, or of course, much later on, The Ghost of Tom Joad, or you're talking about it in terms of these remnants and everything from certain facets of 1980s throwback culture to, you know, alt country and No Depression as a zine covering alt country that very much tries to recapture a kind of sense of traditionalism through attention to the folk revivals of the 1960s and 70s. I would think of them as less like constellations and more like individual stars that are sort of shot off into different directions by the 1980s and 1990s that serve as the kind of representation of the Great Depression in American memory by that period of time, which helps explain why you can get an effort to try to unify it all through things like Tom Brokaw's, you know, Greatest Generation mythology, you know, which he tries to offer almost, you might say, like a uniform field theory of what all this is to bring some semblance of memorial structure to all of these various ways in which by that time the Great Depression is shot off into ways that make it just much more individualized, but also easier to commercialize too, you know, to sell the Great Depression as a certain mode or an ethic or a motif or a style that can show up in popular culture as much as anything else.
But I think that notion of the greatest generation, I think it really ties into the idea of the Waltons and how the Great Depression gets recast along conservative lines, that it wasn't an innovative government response and these programs that provided jobs, put people back to work. It was just the character of the people.
That's right.
If you had the right character, if your family was strong enough, your values were the right ones, you could get through this.
That's right.
Is kind of an underhanded way of pointing the finger at people for their own problems, right?
And that's right.
It could become an easy smokescreen for rolling back programs that you don't really need that, because if you could just get your own act together, you can solve your own problems. That we move into a much harsher time period, which you're stressing, these hard times just become ingrained in the present.
Right. And I think that pursuit of, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, the sort of opportunity society or emphasis in conservative circles on an individual responsibility. Well, I would say there's an attendant individualization of memory, too, that just elides or erases or doesn't provide much framework for remembering the New Deal. It all becomes the Great Depression as it happened to me and my family, without necessarily the New Deal being a subsequent framework for understanding those memories. And that's where I think, you know, that's, you know, to sort of begin to end where I often begin, when I ask people, you know, about the Great Depression or what do they remember. Obviously these days, folks who do remember the Great Depression are quite up in years, who remembered it directly. It may have been children or teenagers when they initially remembered it. Their odds are they weren't in middle age when they were going through the Great Depression. So whatever's left these days as far as the Great Depression in American memory is often filtered secondhand, third hand, in terms of your parents' stories, your grandparents' stories, or, you know, these days your great grandparents' stories. And many of those, I think there's a striking element of how individualized they are, how they're focused on this is what I experienced or how we made it or how I made it through without any of these attendant social or political structures or helps. And I think that, you know, is something that I've noticed over the course, if you're looking at the long sort of view of all this, that is a development that happens over time. And it happens in many ways, not naturally, but I think as part of a political project that I'll freely admit that I'm still working on the research, still trying to make sense of, but is essential for understanding why and how a narrative or a viewpoint on why bad things happen to people in a capitalistic framework, why it's all their fault, you know, and only their fault, and not necessarily related to more structural arrangements. I think there's a memorial story in there that is all about forgetting the Great Depression as a structural experience, as a systemic experience, as a seismic experience, as a social experience, as something shared between people, and forgetting of it as that, while at the same time and only remembering of it as something that happened to an individual. And by the 1970s and 1980s, that tends to be the way in which the Great Depression is narrated, that is told.
But to me, it seems like one of the things that's happening as this past is getting recast, forgotten and recast, that's the same period of time where you have inequality that begins to widen in society. Right. So I'm channeling my inner Bernie Sanders here,
I suppose,
in the conversation.
But I think it shows up in you think about it with, even popular artists. Let's take Bruce Springsteen, for instance. I mean, his characters are living in a kind of New Deal-less world. not all of them, of course, but at least the ones that are most directly derived from the Woody Guthrie mode, and those are, whether they're on Nebraska, whether they're on Ghost of Chom Joe, they seem to be these types of figures that are living through that type of environment. And I think it's perhaps with a deep irony that all of that is the way in which the Great Depression is treated, and deprivation or hard times is treated, and how we talk about them at the very moment when finally in the 1990s, we get a national monument to Franklin D. Roosevelt. and it's if you go to that and look at it, I think it's instructive that it's off the National Mall, that it's a very somewhat abstract national monument. It has Eleanor Roosevelt there as well. It has the emphasis on the four freedoms, which is quite apt, but it also has strikingly men all disheveled, seemingly downtrodden and waiting in line. Which is, I think, as much of anything, a kind of metaphor for what way in which many Americans still feel today, but they're waiting in line for what?
But I think your point about, well, why does this memory matter? This relationship, you look back at the New Deal, it tells us something about people's relationship to capitalism, to the state, and it gets remembered in a particular way. That leads to the fragmentation of the memory of what FDR did, what was innovative about that past, the solutions that they came up with. And you end up in this age of fend for yourself individualism. Mm-hmm. And then you plunge into these crises like the Great Recession. You plunge into the COVID pandemic, and maybe these things end up having a much bigger toll because of options that weren't available to ourselves, how we understood our national past, certain options had already been discredited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the book is fundamentally interested in capitalism's traumas and the systemic traumas. And we've seen those. I mean, I've seen it obviously in my lifetime and your lifetime. Most pointedly, the housing crisis and crash in 2007, 2008. And then most notably over a million Americans dead from COVID. And part of that's because the ethic was get back to work, open the shops. It's just a bug. It's just a flu. And millions of Americans believing that and believing it fervently that it was nothing that, or being forced into situations in which they had to decide between their own health or housing, their own personal health or being able to feed their kids. And I mean, these types of decisions are laid out in which you don't have a profound memorial infrastructure for alternatives, for different ways of approaching this that are more derived from the New Deal era. And I think even more strikingly, I can add just contemporary commentary on it, is what will be the memorial to the COVID dead? There are memorials to the Civil War dead, to the World War I dead, World War II dead, Vietnam War dead, COVID or Korean War dead. What will be the memorials to that, to our citizens who died because of COVID?
It's really a debate over which political leadership was more inept in responding to it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that is, aside from all of these kind of reiterations you see, or these sometimes kind of regurgitations of new deals or pursuits of green new deals or what have you, I think it's our inability to remember properly from these eras of capitalistic collapse and trauma and depression and state responses to it. It's just simply normalizes new types of hard times that even the New Dealers could never imagine, much less, you know, maybe managed or undone. But it seems like we're just kind of captured in this fecklessness in the face of it all. And whether or not, you know, mass remembrance would be effective or not, I think the fact that there isn't even mass remembrance going on is instructive of the contemporary point that we're at, that is quite contrary to the mass remembrance or attempts at mass remembrance in the first years after the Great Depression had ended, of a reckoning through memory.
Darren, thank you so much for sharing your time with me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Rick. I really enjoyed this. Thank you for the conversation.
Darren E. Grem is an associate professor of history and Southern studies at the University of Mississippi. He's the author of The Blessings of Business, How Corporations Shape Conservative Christianity. I've been talking with him about his book project, Hard Times USA, The Great Depression and New Deal in American Memory. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, the best way to support the podcast is to tell others and share a link. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.